I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
The hardest part would absolutely be the coffee withdrawals. That is so difficult. I mean, I'm struggling literally right now because I'm really tired and I want a coffee.
For Muslims around the world, the ninth month of the Islamic calendar marks the observation of Ramadan.
It's a month where Muslims are essentially obligated to fast from sunrise to sunset. But you're supposed to kind of control your desires and yourself and kind of get a hold on your spirituality during this month. It's like a month training.
For Guardian reporter Mustafa Rashwani, it's a month of fasting, prayer, and
في امر من القياده العليا بازاله باب الحاره
television.
فارد تحكي انت والشيخ عبد العليم مع رجال الحاره مشان ما حدا يقاومنا.
During the breaking of the fast, the iftar, and right after, the TV shows will line up the best, you know, the best new shows coming out of the Middle East for these kind of prime time slots.
In the past few decades, this time has become a sort of Oscar season, with production companies across the Middle East releasing their best shows. For diaspora communities, these shows are about entertainment, but also connection. Today, how Ramadan shows became a must-watch for the diaspora. It's Monday, the 3rd of May. So Mustafa, tell me about a regular day during Ramadan.
Okay, so a regular day in Ramadan usually starts at around an hour before sunrise. So this is called suhoor. Suhoor is like a pre-fast meal and hangout to some degree. So why we do this, we normally wake up just before sunrise to have some water and some food so that we can prepare ourselves for the day and also to pray the morning prayers. And so from that moment until sunset, no food, no drinks, no swearing, no nothing. Usually you're not supposed to kind of have an easy day. You're supposed to have a normal day. So I usually go to work and I try and maintain my routine as I would if I wasn't fasting. So I would jump on a train and I'll go to work. Sunset these days is around 5:30. So usually when the clock hits five, I kind of try and duck out of work really quick. I hope none of my bosses are listening to this. And head home. Usually I get there around just before sunset. And then what would normally be happening, especially if I go to my parents' place, and on the first day of Ramadan, you have to. It's really it's a strong cultural tradition that you must begin Ramadan with your family. So I've just arrived at my parents' house, and I'm sure they've been preparing an enormous feast all day. And I'm extremely excited for it because I'm very hungry, I'm very thirsty, and I'm very irritable. But I'll also be walking into a cacophony of noise. I'm sure the TV will be going, the radio will be going. Someone will be streaming something. This is how we prepare for sunset. Usually the radio will play, they'll mute everything else and the radio will play the adhan to know when we can eat. Iftar is the breaking of our fast. So it's the meal that we have at the conclusion of the day, so at sunset. In the Lebanese cultural tradition, certainly in my family, we have a bowl of soup to begin the meal. So we have our soup and then we have our food and then we pray the sunset prayer. And it's at that point that we kind of chill out, right? So most of the family will come together and most Muslim families will do this as well. We'll sit together and we'll watch these TV shows, these really special TV shows that are made specifically for Ramadan called Musalsalat.
Abi?
Can you tell me about Musalsalat?
So Musalsalat in Arabic, it literally just means, I think it just means like TV show, something like that, or soap opera, right? But it's come to kind of mean all the shows that come out during Ramadan. So typically, these are shows that run for the whole month. So there will be an episode that is released each day to coincide with iftar, or at least like the time after iftar.
Since it's the first night, it's very much played by ear. What plays, you know, right after dinner? What plays at dessert time? What plays later? And then I think they'll start to shape their watching schedule for the rest of the month. tonight.
Yalla, salam alaikum.
And they usually culminate in like a finale that happens on either the last day or on Eid. Eid is the day we celebrate the end of Ramadan.
What sorts of TV shows are included?
All sorts. You have soap operas, grand historical epics, gangster stories and crime stories. There's a lot of police stories this year. It really is honestly like the Oscar season of the Middle East.
Okay, so we ended up watching a couple of shows, but my family were not impressed by any of them. But the shows that we did watch, one of them was a historical drama set at the beginning of World War I in Syria. And it seems to be about the poor and the rich and some kind of violent kind of, I guess, gang or something like that amongst the town. It's not really clear, couldn't really tell. There was another show called 2020. This is a Lebanese show. This was whilst we were eating. So this is, I think, going to be prime time, quite a prominent show. It looks like it's about gangs in Lebanon. So they were doing some kind of drug deal during a festival. Someone was returning from Hajj, which is the religious pilgrimage that Muslims do. And they were celebrating it and they were also organizing a drug deal at the same time. But again, family were not too invested in either of them. I don't think we will continue watching any of them, but we'll see.
So the shows aren't actually about Ramadan necessarily?
Some are and some are not. Initially, they had kind of religious undertones. Mm. But no, the content right now is extremely varied. I mean, one of the shows that me and my parents are watching are about an undercover cop in a drug ring. So there's nothing to do with Ramadan whatsoever.
What are your favorites?
My favorite are usually the spy thrillers and the historical kind of shows. I really like to kind of engage with like the history of the Middle East and all of the different little details. I mean, that's one of the best parts of family time is discussions and engaging with each other about what we just watched, what we are watching, why it's good. I really love to ask my family questions about, you know, the kind of the side bits of the show, the geography of it, where are they filming this? Do you recognize any of it? Mm. Why are they speaking in that accent? And often it kind of opens discussions about my parents' experiences and their history and what they know about different countries. You know, for example, Dad would say, oh, you know, I went to Cairo when I was like 17. Mm. I can't even remember how old. And I was like, wait, really? Why? Why did you go? What were you doing? What was going on? And then he's like, oh, it was just a random trip that we just went to. And I went to see the pyramids, et cetera, et cetera. And even, you know, everyone will be like, we didn't know this. You didn't tell us. Right?
Wow.
So there's all these kind of moments of discovery, I guess, in these kind of communal discussions.
This is for the podcast.
This
so,
will be a draft.
No, don't worry about it.
My family is made up of a lot of really opinionated people, like my sister Ines.
So, what was your favorite show you've watched?
Mom, what's it called?
Ma Sabiq Al Asrar.
Okay.
Determination.
Ma Sabiq Al Asrar.
She loves the dramas and the soap operas.
Let me set the scene for you.
Go for it.
We're in Egypt. We present to you a really wealthy lawyer. I don't know what her name is to this day. She has three children. One of them's name is Kuki and he's a diabetic and he does die, but it's fine. Anyways, she is married to a trash bag who's cheating on her. And they eventually leave each other and she's secretly in love with like this really hot modern guy. And her son is in a rehabilitation facility for drug problems. And her daughter had a trashy boyfriend who was making her iskar. And the
What's
such.
Get
drunk. You can't get drunk in Egypt, my God.
Okay, so why did you like it?
Because of the drama, okay? Because what you think was actually happening was not what was happening, okay? So the man that she's in love with, she ends up marrying him and moving in. And then all of a sudden, a series of very unfortunate events occur to her, okay? For example, her son ends up back like as a drug addict. Her daughter shames the whole family and has premarital sex with a man with a unibrow.
Wow.
So she forces her to put the hijab on and marry him.
Wow.
Her son Kuki dies from a sugar overdose on the day of either her or her daughter's wedding to the new guy. Ask me why this happened.
Why did this happen?
the man that she's in love with, she was a lawyer and she represented his ex-wife, or she helped his ex-wife get either a termination of her pregnancy or get a divorce, something like that.
Okay.
I'll ask mum to confirm.
So why? But why?
And he wanted revenge.
Right.
So he orchestrated revenge on this lawyer. He made her believe that she was in love with him. And then he sent Monobrow to seduce the daughter. And then he sent really bad friends to the son to get him on drugs. And then he gave Cookie sugar and killed him.
I'm so confused. He gave him sugar. Okay.
Because he's a type 1 diabetic.
Okay.
And he was like, then they're like, give Cookie the insulin. And you can see him slow motion with the Arabic music in the background, like going and dropping the insulin dramatically. And so Cookie dies. Is this medically accurate? No.
Why did you like it, but on like a deep level? Like, why did you like it?
There's no depth to it. That's why I liked it. It's just complete melodrama. It's everything you want in an Arabic TV show. I don't want anything historic. I don't want anything political. I just want bougie Arabs and drama and twists and turns. That's all I want.
Okay, so Musalsalat is this tradition of Arabic TV that is viewed particularly during Ramadan. I'm wondering how these two things became linked together. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think of this ancient tradition and primetime TV together.
Right. Well, I mean, the easy answer is essentially capitalism. There was a chance to make a lot of money. And all these production companies took it. But I guess on a deeper level, you could say also it comes from an understanding of Ramadan, to understand that people do want something to unwind with, something to sit down with family, and people's routines, I guess. Because inevitably, if 1.8 billion people around the world, and that's the Muslim population, are doing the same thing, fasting from sunset to sunrise, a lot of the routines are going to be very similar. And that's one of the interesting things about Ramadan, is that it kind of resets your daily routine, and then suddenly you and your family and your friends and everyone, we're all eating at the same time. We're all doing everything at the same time. So in it's kind of both ways, you know. It's in many ways, it's just about making money, but in other ways, it reflects a real understanding of Ramadan, what people want.
When did this industry realize that there was a need and a want for this type of content?
It really took off in the 90s. And the screen industry in the Middle East, which was mainly at the time based around Egypt and the Egyptian film industry, they began to work out that there's a huge opportunity for shows in Ramadan. And over time, their success has kind of fostered greater success. It's kind of become like a loop, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy. They saw a market and everyone else kind of jumped onto that as well. And it's just become bigger and more popular.
Have you seen that progression yourself, these shows becoming bigger and bigger within your lifetime?
Oh, yeah, massively. So the shows themselves, if you watch, for example, shows from the 90s and the 2000s, which is when I kind of started, and then compare them to shows now, the production values have increased enormously.
Mm, what do you mean?
Just looking at it, it just doesn't look like it was filmed on an iPhone. That's kind of the first place to start. I mean, even then, some of the old shows were literally blurry. Like you're just kind of squinting, like, what's going on?
Like there's Vaso on the lens.
Yeah. You're just kind of leaning in. Like, does everyone know what's going on? I don't know whether to ask. Over time, with more money, more production companies got involved. The actors became much better. You know, much less tacky. And so, with the increased production costs and money that was coming in, they could tackle bigger themes and bigger projects and bigger ideas.
Next, how Musalsalat fosters connection between migrant parents and their children. So Mustafa, you said that you started watching these shows in the 90s and early 2000s. How were you actually watching them at the time in Australia? Because I imagine, you know, this is well before streaming services and other things.
Right. So it kind of matters where you are in the world. Mm. So obviously, if you're in Egypt or in the Middle East, you just watch them on TV. But if you lived in Australia, you would have to go to a video shop and hope that they had it. So they would record the TV shows from last year and then put them on VHS tapes and then, you know, sell them to people the next year.
And I remember I used to go with my mum to Fairfield and go to the different, I think there's maybe one or two left in the area where you can go and buy all the different drama series.
This is with Jan Faddis. She is currently doing a PhD looking at satellite TV and the way it affects Arabic diasporic audiences. And she told me her mum used to take her to video shops around Western Sydney to get these VHS tapes.
And it wasn't just Arabic content. You had a lot of Bollywood content that was being dubbed and you had a lot of Turkish drama that was also being dubbed and you could literally pick out whichever series you were looking for. It was like YouTube just in physical form, really.
It was like Blockbuster for Arabs, you know?
So there were actually just video stores set aside for this entirely?
Yep.
Wow.
It was amazing. I have really vague memories because when I started kind of fasting, we had cable. They had like the satellite connected to the cable, and we'd have a couple of channels that we could scroll through. But I have vague memories of the video shops that my parents would go and they would buy. It was like box sets almost, right? You'd get the whole season, and then you'd watch it.
Mm.
But around mid 90s to the early 2000s, there was a lot of satellite options. So the video stores kind of died out quite quickly, and everybody kind of reverted to satellite, certainly everyone in Australia, to having like a little box. So it's like a little box that you would plug into the wall. It's kind of like Foxtel.
So there were specific channels you could get via cable.
Yes.
What were those channels?
That's a good question, right? Because the channels are still around. So the most important one was ART, Arabic Radio and Television. It's based in Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
ART was the first and most prominent one, and to some degree still is. So my parents still watch ART, and it still shows a variety of shows from across the Middle East. So there's Lebanese, Syrian, and Egyptian shows.
So as these shows became more easily accessible around the world, what did we see?
What we saw was the birth of enormous, internationally successful shows, right? And probably the most prominent example is this historical soap opera called Bab al-Hara. Which literally translates to the neighborhood's gate. And it was enormously popular. It was set in Damascus around the turn of the century and follows a family in their drama in pre-colonial Syria. So that ran for 10 seasons. And of course, those 10 seasons crossed over with the Syrian war. And from my understanding, it did affect production, and they did pause production to some degree, but I think, or they moved production as well to I think it was a Gulf state. But I guess the incredible thing was that they persisted through the war, and they continued to produce the show during the war. One of the more interesting elements of it, to me, was how big the entire industry had become. It kind of links into that, because the main reason they wanted to continue was its enormous popularity.
Yeah.
It was hugely popular. The second season finale, now there are no official numbers, so I can't tell you with certainty how popular. But according to sources, right, the second season's finale reached 50 million people.
Wow.
Which is a lot of people to reach a Middle Eastern show.
I'm trying to think how that compares to like a Game of Thrones finale, right? Finale viewing numbers. I'm Googling it now. Hold on. 13.6 million people in the US watched the final episode of the last Game of Thrones season.
13. Okay, so there you go. There's some context, right? 50 million people watched the second series. So this is a really, really, really big show, right? And actually for me personally, this show was a pretty big turning point.
How so? What do you mean by that?
When I was a kid, I didn't really pay much attention to these shows. You know, they were just the things that my parents watched at Ramadan. You know, I wasn't really invested in them. And they were often on in the background. Mm. My language skills were not that strong, so I didn't really understand what was going on. But I think that's a really important part to the entire thing, because when this show came out and I started to actually understand what was happening. So, yeah, it wasn't until I was a teenager that it clicked in that way that I was able to kind of appreciate them and understand them. And it's something that Wijen kind of talks about too, how it wasn't until she was also a bit older that she began to appreciate these musalsalat. For someone like myself, like someone young from the Lebanese diaspora, that was probably the first time I fully understood the TV show. Like, I understood clearly what was going on, who the characters were, what they were doing and why they were doing it. And so I could tag along.
And what was so extraordinary about this show to you?
The first and most important thing was that I understood it. Mm. And that might be a very basic fact, but it's something that it's hard to explain, because as a kid, I knew a little bit of Arabic. I never visited Lebanon. I didn't visit until I was 25. So I didn't have any chance to use Arabic properly. And so it was a niggling part of me. Right, that I spoke in English, but my identity was Arab. It's a very strange kind of disconnect, because a lot of the things that I would do, or for example, all of the things I would eat would be, you know, Lebanese food, right? And they all have, you know, Lebanese Arabic names. But then if someone was to ask me, for example, at school, what did you eat? And I would tell them, you know, I had kibbeh, and they're like, oh, what's that? I don't know. I didn't have the connection between like what I spoke and who I was.
Mm.
So the reason why Bab al-Hara was so important was because of language, right? Because I understood it. Right, it was a sudden moment where my identity and my language fused together. So I could go to school and discuss it with my friends, who were also from the Arab diaspora, and they also understood it. So suddenly we had this kind of cultural moment amongst ourselves, me and my friends, where we were talking about something in Arabic, but we were talking about it in English. And I think it was a really important moment for me. It was a really important identity moment, realistically, right? Because it suddenly felt like I didn't need to battle myself, right? It could be married, you know. I could work it all out.
So Mustafa, you just told us about how musalsalat helped inform your identity. Is there any other impact that these TV shows had on your life?
I mean, there's a lot to be said there about what it meant. But I think the most important part of that is that it allowed us to understand our parents.
How so?
It's really interesting to say that, and I'm just trying to work out the best way to explain this. Because a lot of the diaspora kind of people from my generation, so they're technically second generation, so their parents all migrated, or even some people who themselves migrated at a very young age, there's a huge disconnect between our experiences and our parents' experiences. My parents, they grew up in war-torn Lebanon. Most of their teenage years were spent during the worst years of the war. So a lot of their childhood experiences are really rough and really terrible, and it contained a lot of tragedy and trauma.
Mm.
Then, of course, they come to Australia, and then they have me and my siblings. And, of course, our experiences are vastly different to theirs. You know, we went to school in Western Sydney, and, you know, we went to university, and there was all these kinds of things that we did that they never done. They never had the opportunity to do. So there's a huge disconnect in terms of their experiences and our experiences, right? It's just, they're just worlds away.
Mm.
The shows provided a glimpse into their mindset, into their minds, into their experiences, because a lot of the shows, of course, would reflect life in the Middle East.
And I imagine also for your parents, it would be really special to watch these TV shows that are creative and beautiful and entertaining in their native tongue.
Yeah, absolutely. It's massively important to them. And they've been watching these shows for a long time, pretty much since I was born. I don't know Ramadan without the shows. Mm. And they're a really important way for them to kind of connect with their past and as well as with their homelands.
I think for my parents, it is a connection to back home.
And it's something that Wijen talks about too, right? Her family is from Iraq, and access to television in Iraqi was very important to her parents.
For them, their idea of home, whatever that may be, even though I think it's changed for them over the years, because that you see Australia as being hope. Iraq is still home to them. That's where they grew up.
Mm.
So I think for them, for my parents, it's definitely that connection to not only just knowing what's going on back home, but also understanding cultural references and that they're still in the know, if that makes sense, and not feeling left out. Yeah. And my parents aren't strong English speakers. They can definitely get by, but they're not going to sit there and watch content in English. They're going to sit there and watch content in their native tongue because it allows them to use their native tongue. They're stronger in that and it's more entertainment value.
The fact that the shows engaged our parents, certainly my parents, and would speak to them, told me a lot about their experiences. It told me a lot about what they went through, what their country is like, why they feel so connected to their country, to their language, what they feel like they might be losing in having migrated. All of these little moments, of course, paint a bigger picture. And the more I understand my parents, the more I understand myself, you know, the more I understand where I come from.
I mean, these are some pretty profound realizations to have come out of television, right?
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's two things there, right? Like, the first is that obviously television is just, you know, it's just entertainment. No one really cares. Doesn't really matter. But inherently, I really, really, really disagree with that. I think television is just the next step in storytelling. Storytelling is really inherent to how we understand ourselves. It's how we can reflect on ourselves. And the best way to do that is honestly, TV. TV is so accessible and it's presenting so many different and unique stories. I mean, one of the beauties of Musalsalat is that you're seeing on TV things you never thought you'd see on TV.
Mm.
That's really one of the most powerful elements of it. Certainly as like a diaspora, you know, Arab, you know, I'd never thought I would see gangsters of Beirut, you know, on TV. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never thought that would happen before because TV to me was what TV is in Australia, which is largely quite, you know, monolithic to some degree.
Mm.
But with these Musalsalat, you see this variety, you see these different stories. I don't necessarily think that TV is such a strange place to find yourself. I think it's the opposite. I think it's the perfect place to find yourself.
Gawi, Ali Mkhalla, Gawi!
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum.
Thanks to Mustafa Roshwani for his time. You can read his piece about Musalsalat at theguardian.com and we've linked it on the Full Story page as well. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Beater, Joe Koning, and Miles Herbert. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.